refiners want even more renewable fuel standard exemptions. The heat is building between the U.S. and China while China continues to make big ag buys. But the markets are, in Pam Johnson's words, blah. Another state fair cancels, but Missouri says they're on. And a week from today, we'll be watching baseball again. And I get to talk about it all with the smartest people in the business on the AgriTalk Free For All.
Live from a fantastic Friday via Farm Journal broadcast, this is AgriTalk. This morning, it's our Friday Free For All. Panelists Jim Wiesmeyer, Sean Haney, and Pam Johnson join us. And right after the news, Jennifer Scheich from Farm Journal's Pork. I'm handsome newsman Davis Michelson, now filling in for the lollygagging Chip Flory, the benevolent overlord himself, John Harris.
I'm doing a little lollygagging myself, I think.
Are you?
That's a beautiful day here in northern Indiana. It's a good day to lollygag.
Yeah, same here in northeast Iowa. Gorgeous. And I wrote the news, got out in front of it, and had about a half an hour. And I just went outside and enjoyed the weather just a little bit. It's beautiful here.
Oh, that's nice. And well, and here's my idea of lollygagging today. There's a whole bunch going on in the news, and I get to sit back and listen to the likes of Pam Johnson, Sean Haney, and Jim Wiesmeyer explain it all to me.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
You can't get any better than that.
That's a good spot. It's a good spot.
That is a good spot. And we'll start with you explaining it to me. Davis, what's going on in the news today?
Well, as far as explanation, I don't know. We may leave that to the experts. But I'll tell you what's happening. The Trump administration says it's mulling a travel ban that would prohibit Chinese Communist Party members from entering the United States. This comes after comments from the president earlier this week indicating he hoped to cool flaring tensions by not sanctioning Chinese officials involved in alleged human rights violations and China's more aggressive stance toward Hong Kong. But
so he's got a little ice in one hand, a little fire in the other, huh?
Yeah, I think so, what we got going there. But both the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times have reported the administration's designs on banning the Communist Party members and their families from entering the U.S. The party reportedly has more than 90 million members, although membership is not made public. And that could make it sticky, John. I wonder if that could just lead to if you're a Chinese national, you can't come here. Could we see something like that?
But some of them aren't too hard to pick out. I mean, you know who some of the leadership is, sure. And particularly those with the American government that are in China will be able to identify some points that'll hit home in those sanctions.
Mm-hmm. Well, meanwhile, Attorney General William Barr yesterday called on U.S. businesses to avoid doing business with the Chinese Communist Party, saying the CCP is on a mission to supplant the United States' dominance in the world economy. Speaking in Grand Rapids, Michigan, Barr said, quote, "The ultimate ambition of China's rulers is not to trade with the United States. It is to raid the United States." He continued, "If you are an American business leader appeasing the People's Republic of China, that may bring you short-term rewards, but in the end, the PRC's goal is to replace you." I don't think there's ever been a time when I've used the word communist so many times in a news broadcast. And this is, Trump wants tensions to cool down, he said. I mean, we didn't even get into the South China Sea. We can leave that for another day. But for Pete's sake, something seems amiss.
Well, they are certainly applying pressure. We're going to talk to Jim about this a little bit later. We've been talking about it on the Signal to Noise podcast in here on AgriTalk for a few weeks, and he's good at tracking exactly where that temperature sits, so we'll get an update from Jim in a minute.
Very good. Well, the United States, along with the UK and Canada, have accused Russian hackers of targeting COVID-19 virus research databases. While they say the research has not been impeded by the attacks, intelligence agencies suspect a group called Cozy Bear has been attempting to steal information. And I should point out, Russian officials have denied the allegations, John.
And the Trump administration was quick to add China onto that news. Another interesting development in your previous story.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you mentioned before, the EPA, that's the Environmental Protection Agency, reports 6 more requests for biofuel mandate exceptions have been filed. That brings the total number of requests up to 86, ranging from compliance year 2011 through 2020. Earlier this week, the Renewable Fuels Association calculated pandemic-related losses to the biofuels industry at nearly $3.5 billion. Meanwhile, according to U.S. government figures, The government has collected more than $2 billion in fuel taxes in June. That more than doubled May's intake, suggesting drivers are getting back on the road after pandemic-related shut-ins. Fuel demand is on the rise here. It'd be nice to get some relief on the ethanol side.
Yes, yes, it would indeed. We'll talk about that a little bit with Pam Johnson on today's show. Thanks, Davis. Appreciate it.
You bet.
Right. Let's turn to Jennifer Scheich, editor of Farm Journal's Pork. And Jennifer, you were on here yesterday with Ty and talking a little bit about your column, about your experience showing livestock last week with your kids. And first of all, thank you for sharing that. I know from our own experience here in our house, looking at getting our kids back out in events and looking, we've had to make some choices about schools and what they're going to do this fall. I know a lot of parents are looking at this from the perspective of travel baseball teams, and it's very similar. I appreciate you sharing your thoughts and kind of what you experienced last week going to a livestock show.
No problem. It was a hard topic to write about because I thought, I don't know the answer to this, but hopefully I can at least be honest about where I'm at with it. And I was got a lot of feedback from other readers and people who said, you know, they're just in the same boat and it's challenging and they're glad they're not alone in their concern.
Certainly. And it helps having someone else's perspective on how they came out in assessing some of those questions. And there are a lot of families like yours still looking at those because there are still livestock shows going on. What is the status right now? What livestock shows are moving forward? Are they moving? Are most of them moving to virtual shows or do we still have some live shows? What's the status right now?
Well, I think you're seeing a lot of the county fairs, not all, but a lot of county fairs and a lot of the state fairs, as you know, canceling their shows. But there have also been several what I would call pop-up shows or replacement shows. So there's more and more small county-level shows that are starting to rise up. And, I mean, they're really, like, coming together within a matter of a week or two in some cases. People aren't planning very far out. There's a lot more word of mouth and real grassroots level shows. Some of the big fall shows haven't canceled yet, so there's a lot of speculation out there as sports, you know, are canceled for the fall in some schools or we're waiting those decisions. You know, one of the thoughts on our mind is, well, do we get more livestock to take to some of those shows in the fall that we normally couldn't go to because of sports? So, you know, it's interesting. They're able to do quite a bit of social distancing at some of these livestock shows and feel like they've got some measures in place to be able to make it work. But we all know that can change overnight too. So kind of a bit of a gamble right now.
Indeed. You and I were talking the other day and you told me that some of the larger shows are already thinking about if they do move forward because so many other shows have canceled, there may be a huge influx of interest and they're looking at possibly limiting who can enter some of these shows if they do move forward?
Yes, yes. I've heard that some of the shows are going to limit it to only people who participated in it in the past. Again, I don't know any of these rules for sure yet, but they're definitely having to take a hard look at what's realistic and what can they fit.
All right, and how they can keep everybody safe in those while still allowing these important events to go on. Jennifer, thanks so much for the update. We appreciate it.
No problem. Have a great day.
You too. It's Jennifer Scheich, editor of Farm Journal's Pork. When we come back, it's the free-for-all on AgriTalk.
No doubt you've heard of MetLife, but did you know that MetLife Investment Management has over 100 years of ag lending experience? The MetLife Investment Management team maintains close relationships with its borrowers and can structure a customized loan with flexible terms to meet your financial needs. Looking to expand, refinance, or recapitalize? Consider MetLife Investment Management. Learn more at MetLife.com/ag.
Your next piece of equipment is on MachineryPete.com. Search equipment from dealerships across the country to find what you're looking for. Only on MachineryPete.com.
And you know, this is exactly the kind of music I picture Machinery Pete listening to in the cab of his tractor as he's driving around out there. Hey, welcome to the Friday Free-for-All. I'm John Harris. sitting in for Chip Flory, enjoying the last day of his vacation out fishing today. We'll be glad to have him back on Monday when he'll be joined by Machinery Pete and a few others. But right now it's the Friday free-for-all, and Jim Wiesmeyer, a week from today, we'll be sitting down. Well, actually, a week from yesterday, you get to enjoy the first taste of 2020 baseball.
Yeah, we just don't know if we'll have a stadium in D.C. to play in because of the constrictions on COVID in D.C. They're looking for another ballpark, by the way, but we have an exhibition game. Yeah, we have an exhibition game this Saturday, tomorrow in Philadelphia, so I can't wait.
Yeah, you guys pick up a few extra preseason games. My Cardinals only have one, and then we start a week from today against the Pirates. You start a week from yesterday, as I said, against the Yankees. It'll be good to have baseball back in front of us.
Yeah. Absolutely. I just hope it will continue with the way the COVID is increasing.
Yeah, that is going to be something to watch. Along those lines, Pam Johnson from Iowa, you and I were talking before we got started on the show today. You said it's County Fair Week up in your neck of the woods. What does County Fair Week look like in 2020 in Northern Iowa?
Well, it's certainly modified, John, but, you know, County Fair is one of the highlights for families in rural communities in the summer. And so in figuring out how to keep those kids and families safe, the Fair Board did a great job. Kids were allowed to do live shows with physical distancing. They couldn't take their animals into the barns, but they could show them and stay apart from each other and have a real fair and, you know, enjoy the fruits of their labors for the whole year of getting up every day and feeding and working with those animals. So made the kids happy, and it was a small part of normalcy back.
Yeah, and that really is so important for these kids. I mean, I know with my own kids, just the notion of getting out and getting out to something that looks like normal is so important for them, and they really latch on to it. But when you stack on all the hard work that these 4-H kids have done leading up to this event, to not be able to have any payoff on that would just be really hard to swallow. So I'm glad that in your county they were at least able to have some conclusion, some payoff for that work for them.
Yep, you know, 4-H and FFA, backbone of rural America, right? And then the support of the whole community usually rallies around them and helps support their projects and helps sell them in the end. A lot of kids use it for their college funds. And so it was great to be back, and it streamed it to those who couldn't attend. Kids could only have two people with them, and a lot of times that ended up being their parents. So everybody else could watch it either live or later on Facebook Live, which was really nice.
Yeah, what about that financial aspect of this? Because that is so key. I mean, that's really one of the larger reasons why these are held, is because it does provide that important scholarship money for these kids through the auctions. Were you able to auction those animals at your county?
Yes, we're going to in a different form. The local radio station is going to help provide a context, but supporters and Fair Board members are out there, as usual, drumming up support from local businesses and local families to help support these kids. There were issues, you know, trying to find a spot at local lockers to have. We always get our meat for the year during the Floyd County Fair, and so you were lucky if you got a spot there, but, you know, people really worked with us to get those animals marketed and taken so that people could have meat.
And those are really some of the unsung heroes out there across rural America, is the people working behind the scenes to make sure that there are bidders ready for those auctions. Most people don't realize all of the work that goes on behind the scenes to make sure that there are bidders ready to support those 4-H and FFA kids that are out there working so hard. I'm going to call out one of them right now just because I worked with him for years at the Illinois State Fair, and that's John Slayton in Illinois. Worked very quietly behind the scenes and did a lot of work to make sure that those kids were rewarded. And there's somebody like that at every county and every state that has a fair that goes on.
So true.
So true. Hey, Sean, what are you seeing up in Sean Haney from Real Agriculture? Is there a similar phenomenon up in Canada?
In terms of the state fairs?
The state fairs and kids showing livestock?
Oh, absolutely. Mostly through 4-H. I would say that would be the main mechanism. You know, a lot of the beef sales were back in May. They were obviously very, very different, either done virtually or ways like that are just probably outright canceled. You know, obviously a big struggle, right, to try to get through it, but she'll try to pass on the lessons and give the kids the experience of the whole 4-H experience. You know, and like you said, you know, selling those animals, a lot of that money goes into kids' education funds and things like that. So, yeah, that would be the main mechanism.
Yep. But, and again, if you haven't read it yet, Jennifer Shike's article or column in, if you go to porkbusiness.com and check it out, and her experience of trying to weigh all of the competing pressures on deciding whether to go to a livestock show, and if you do, what you can do to keep your kids safe. Again, it's something. It's not just exclusive to these livestock shows. It's the same thought process going through really every mother's mind right now, and every father's mind. And especially now as we get ready for, it seems hard to believe, but we're already getting ready for fall school decisions. I know here in our district in northern Indiana, we had to make a choice whether or not our kids were going to physically go to school or continue in a virtual classroom. And I know that's a choice that a lot of parents are having to make right now. Sean, again, from the Canadian perspective, what's going on there?
Same as in the U.S. Wait and see. It probably changes every 12 hours on what is going to happen. A lot of parents, I would say the parents that I talk to in rural communities, they want their kids to go back to school. The whole online experience this past spring was, it was an experience and not a great one. It was a real challenge. All put together very, very quickly. You know, struggle for teachers, struggle for kids. So it would be like nice to be back to normal. Although I would say there's a health concern, continues to focus on the health of the kids. You know, kids in these age categories, they're not the ones that are passing away or being deceased. But we don't talk a lot about the teachers. You know, some of the teachers are in these risk categories, and that doesn't get discussed enough. But I talked to two college deans of ag colleges in Canada this week on Real Ag Radio, and man, what a struggle that is, trying to figure out what is the best model. You know, how do you teach welding online? How do you teach a vet lab online, right? It's really, so they're basically looking at it program by program. And what, you know, if you're into an introductory psychology class, well, that can be online. If it is that welding class, you probably need to be on campus. And that's kind of what I got from the colleges this week.
Yeah, our school district here has done virtual learning for snow days because we get a fair amount of them up here. And has done it for a few years, so it's not something new to them. But still, the experience this last spring, we all thought was pretty lacking. And so if it's a district that's experienced with it, not performing anywhere near the same quality that you get in the classroom, you got to imagine what it's like for those schools that had to take it up for the very first time. So it's going to be interesting to see how this develops into this fall, Sean.
Yeah, and John, let's talk about rural broadband. You know, there's a lot of these kids that are being required to be in a virtual classroom, and they can barely download an attachment to an email that's of small size. And, you know, kids having to get their mom to take them to the local grain elevator so they can hack into the grain elevator Wi-Fi to do their schoolwork. There's a lot of challenges. Now, we try to make the best of it, though, right? And if there is some sort of hybrid model for this fall, I hope we've learned from some of our lessons from the spring, and it's a little bit better in the delivery and the consistency across grades and teachers and subjects. If it's the same, I think it's going to be disappointing. President Trump definitely doubling down with all 2 feet in on school needs to be back. Yeah. I don't understand totally why he's dying on that mountain, so to speak, as much as he is, because I think as I talk to parents in both countries, they're sort of shrugging their shoulders and they're not sure what the best answer is.
Go ahead, Pam, real quickly.
Yeah, excuse me, John. You know, if we want schools to be back,
then we have to do what we can do to get the health crisis under control. And when the Trump administration comes out and says science should not be in the way of schools reopening, we have to pay attention to the science.
Yes, we do indeed. All right, when we come back, it's a Friday free-for-all. We're going to talk a little bit China, what's going on there, get the latest update from Jim Wiesmeyer on this back-and-forth verbal war between U.S. and Canada, or U.S. and China, and see if that is going to impact the Phase 1 trade deal when we come back on AgriTalk.
Time for Markets Now with the experts from Pro Farmer.
And that expert is Brian Grady, editor of Pro Farmer. Brian, what are the markets doing today?
Both corn and soybeans. We had another daily export sale this morning of soybeans to unknown destinations. So that's given that market some support. Of note, we've filled Monday's gap down in soybean futures. So technically that market has improved from where it had started the week. On the corn side of things, we still have Monday's gap open. So still some technical work to do for bulls into the weekend. And whether they get that done or not will probably be pretty telling in terms of price action. But I will say weather remains the focal point. It's going to be very hot across the Corn Belt this weekend, put stress on crop. But the two-week forecast continues to call for multiple rain chances. So right now, they're kind of just playing it by ear as they go into the weekend on the weather.
All right, what about the livestock side?
Cattle market yesterday had the big upside breakout above the May highs, showing just limited profit-taking in that August live cattle contract, but some strength in some of the deferred months. So all in all, pretty good response here on Friday and not a lot of price action. So that's somewhat encouraging from a technical perspective, like I said, after yesterday's breakout. On the hog side of things, had a big up move yesterday as well. But they are facing some profit-taking. Slight losses in most of the contracts, but we do have the August contract under fairly heavy pressure here mid-morning. So yesterday's move up didn't trigger any follow-through buying, and it has triggered a little bit of corrective selling to the downside here.
All right. Thanks, Brian. That's Brian Grady, editor of Pro Farmer.
Opinions expressed on AgriTalk do not necessarily reflect the views of Farm Journal Broadcasting, affiliate stations, or sponsors.
I'm Andrew McRae, inviting you to join me for Farming the Countryside, a farmer-focused podcast important to agriculture. It is brought to you by Pivot BioProven. Visit pivotbio.com to find a representative near you.
And welcome back to AgriTalk, or as Jim Wiesmeyer and I like to call it, the warm-up act for DC Signal to Noise. Right, Jim? Totally. I'm John Arith, filling in for Chip Flory today. He's on vacation out fishing. I'll be back on Monday. I got Jim Wiesmeyer from Pro Farmer, Pam Johnson, farmer from Iowa, among other notable things, and Sean Haney from Rural Agriculture in Canada. Let's turn to the renewable fuel standard. Jim, what, six more waiver requests coming in? Well, we don't know exactly when they came in. They were just posted on EPA's website yesterday. What does this bring the total up to?
Well, it's a total request to 86, and you have 27 wow. pending waivers for 2019 and one filed for 2020, and those will be deferred until later action. We don't really know that much more information because the some refineries are requesting their items because they're afraid that if they don't get them in, they'll never be accepted. So I wouldn't read too much into this, John.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's 58 of these are gap year waivers, meaning that they are trying to fill in years that they didn't apply earlier, but now are because of this court ruling saying that the waivers need to be extensions, not new requests. Is that correct, Jim?
Yes, that's after the federal court earlier ruled blending waivers limited to facilities that have, quote, consistently received exemptions in prior years.
Seems to me, Jim, that it should be pretty easy for EPA to rule those 58s renewable fuels waivers invalid and not needed because they could say they're not needed because you didn't apply for them. You're only doing this retroactively. Seems like a pretty easy decision to me.
Logic in these decisions is being escaped, okay? And so, yeah, EPA needs to make a decision. I think right now they're hiding under the skirts of the Energy Department. And as I said last week, the biofuels industry and lawmakers, Senator Ernst and others, should almost daily put pressure on EPA to actually make decisions.
Yeah, in effect, we've got both sides now holding up some EPA appointees. Pam, how is this playing out in Iowa? How urgent is this being played out in the state of Iowa amid this election year?
I think it's one of the top two issues. Ethanol and trade policy of this administration is killing us out in the countryside. And, you know, some people say, well, be patient and keep talking to President Trump. And it's like, We've been screaming at him for 3.5 years, and we still have these waivers. Yeah, we got more transparency with the EPA, but that just, you know, grinds on us more when we continue to see these come at us at a time when we know we have to have good renewable fuel policy.
Yeah, this is watching such foot dragging. Trying to see this any sort of resolution. It's like watching a family trying to do their farm succession deal. but on the other side of it, though, look, you know, Biden puts out his plan this week, and that didn't speak very good for the future of corn ethanol either. You know, very, very aggressive targets on replacing gasoline-powered vehicles to move to electric, providing gas vouchers to help people to do that. So, you know, whether you look at it from the Republican side, the Democrat side, this is not easy times here for the future of corn-based ethanol and what it means for corn demand.
Well, yeah. Part of me would like to say it can't get worse, right? And so I read the Biden plan for rural America, and the renewable fuel industry said, you know, we can work with this policy. And one of his plans, if you read it, is to promote ethanol in the renewable industry. So, you know, a lot of this stuff that happens in the campaign, you get surrounded by a lot of good people who understand rural policy, and if you get a president who will listen to them, you at least have a fighting chance.
Well, and Jim, we've got a new wrinkle in this now, in that the state of Texas, if you believe the most recent polling, the state of Texas is now in play in this election. You and I have talked before, both here and on the Signal to Noise podcast, that I don't think that renewable fuels waivers are a needle mover in Texas the way they are in Iowa, but I don't know that the Trump administration sees that. So does the Trump administration look at those Texas polling numbers and put a bigger pause on making a decision on these waivers?
He may, but in Iowa, it's far more important as an issue, as Pam has just said. If he loses Iowa, he's lost this race for sure. So I just don't understand why he doesn't see that. This is not a total issue in Texas. They have other issues that concern themselves with, demographics and things like that, and also in Georgia. But this should be a no-brainer for the White House.
And you get that, Jim. I get that, and you get that, Jim, about, you know, there are other issues in Texas, but does the president get that?
I don't think so.
Yeah, and that's kind of my point.
Yeah, it's just, you know, I just don't quite understand. Which a lot of things nowadays, it's not understandable. You know, we're in a different world. It should be Iowa, you go ethanol. That's the holy grail issue for corn now. I think in the not so distant future, the corn's going to have to change and will change their holy grail to carbon credits, because that's their next revenue stream that I see.
He has such good gut intuition on so many things as it applies to what gets people to respond to him, positively and negatively. But on the positive side with farmers, and like, this is such an easy one. It's really perplexed me this entire 4 years on why he continues to drag out his feet on it and testing people's will to support him. It's getting to the point where you just sort of, like, that's the way you sort of take it, is that he just thinks he has the vote in his pocket. I don't get it.
It's a shame we didn't have the Iowa State Fair this year, because had Trump gone there, he would have heard it in spades.
Yeah, indeed. But again, I think it's pressure from the Texas oil industry that is keeping the question mark in the president's head. I think he knows what he needs to do in Iowa, but he's worried about what the impact will be in Texas because of that.
We had policy meetings this week, both on a state and national level. We had virtual Corn Congress. And I think we were gut-punched in Iowa because we commissioned a study by economists who show us that under this administration, the steel and aluminum tariffs on China will not be lifted. And that was like, we may have worried about that, but now we know it's true. It was like, oh my God, until those are lifted, China will keep their duties on U.S. meat, pork, ethanol, Iowa's biggest consumers. And so it just is so disheartening to realize that we're not digging ourselves out of this hole when we could be sending a lot of meat products and exporting a lot of ethanol to China, who needs all of it.
But, Jim, are we ever going to get back to what we could view as a normal relationship with China after where we've been? And I'm not putting all the blame on the U.S. here. China has made some very aggressive moves here that also drastically impact that relationship.
No, you had a major, there has been a major change in U.S.-China and actually China Western allies, you know, relationships, and it's going to continue. The fear, although it's not going to impact phase one agreement as we know it now, both countries are saying they're going to fulfill the terms of that agreement. The problem, John, the potential problem is a major mistake by either country, you know, could be made. China's Jinping, the leader, has hardliners pressing him as well. So, again, it's amazing that phase one has held up as much as it has, and China's on an aggressive stance right now in purchasing. And, bottom line on the meat purchases, if China wants to purchase our meat, despite those metal tariffs, they'll issue the waivers, and they have.
Well, and they need, there's clearly some demand there for, especially in the meat products, up significantly on the imports. But, we talk so much about the phase one as if it's the driver of all of this. And because I look at the Canada side, it has been a very poor relationship. China's thrown a lot of veiled threats. When they've needed the products, they've bought them. We have no phase one agreement. We have nothing with them except harsh words going back and forth. It just, the whole thing about the phase one document, there's a number in there and we focus on it. But is that really the driver, like, is the Chinese government like, oh, look, phase one, we've got to make sure that we abide by this. I'm not sure, especially with phase two sort of drifted off and it seems to be there was a lot of work done here. And we're just hoping to make some ag sales now at this point. The only
reason we have a phase one only is because they couldn't separate the other economic issues besides the ag issues. So that's why we had that, if you recall.
Yeah.
That's why the odds are low for a phase two agreement. It's just too significant that China has to give too much.
Well, I guess the bottom line where I'm trying to get to is that, and it's probably unfair saying this to Pam before we go to a break, we can come back to it afterwards, but even if we do have a change in administration after the November election and the tariffs are dropped, it's not going to solve the problems we have with China, probably not for a significant amount of time. We'll talk about that and a lot more when we come back on the AgriTalk Free for All after this commercial break.
Chickens have come home to roost. Find out whose fence they're perched on today on AgriTalk.
And it's Friday free-for-all on AgriTalk. I'm John Harris, filling in for Chip Flory on his last day of vacation. He'll be back with us on Monday. We've got the usual suspects here, Pam Johnson, Jim Wiesmeyer, and Sean Haney. And Pam, I want to give you a chance to respond to what we were talking about before the break. And essentially, I made comments that even if there is a change in administration come November and the tariffs are dropped, things are not going to be great immediately for American agriculture when it comes to China. I don't want to give you a chance to respond to that.
Yeah, thanks. No, you're right. It won't change immediately. It won't turn around on a dime, but it will change, and there is a better alternative. All you got to do is Google Biden's plan for rural America, and the first thing is pursue a trade policy that works for American farmers. How do you do that? You stand up to China, but you work with our allies, and then you make sure the trade policy works for American farmers.
But that's still going to be a long slog to get things back to any sort of regular trade with China if you are indeed going to address some of the intellectual property challenges and other things, which, again,
sure.
Phase one doesn't do.
Sure, but, you know, China, trade with China is all about relationships, and we built them, and we can rebuild them. So I have faith in that.
Yeah, they're transactional, though. Like, I sort of interpret what Biden's saying as sort of like just moving into more like Canada and Australia territory, where it's more a case of pretending the relationship is better than it really is. That's sort of like where we are. I don't know. All this stuff is so, like, I think we've had good evidence here where we've got the soft approach, which, you know, Canada was kind of playing. That hasn't helped. We had the hardline approach, threats, you know, innuendo, what Trump was going to do to them and what, you know, they're going to take their economy down. That necessarily hasn't worked. China is a tough challenge, and it is way bigger than maybe we recognized at first on how big the challenge is in front of us to make some change there in terms of how they behave.
Yeah, well, I think we continue to underestimate what their end game is versus what our end game is in all of this. A couple things I want to move to quickly, because I know, Pam, you wanted to take a moment to recognize a true giant in agriculture that we lost this week.
Yeah, we're remembering the legacy of Owen Newland and what he did to really advance agriculture. So I don't know where to start. You'd have to go on and look at his obituary for Owen Newland, all of the things he did in his lifetime. He started corn referendums that started corn checkoffs that helped farmers get their money from the marketplace. He was instrumental, and he was vice president for North American sales for Pioneer for years, instrumental in teaching farmers how important global trade is through Pioneer missions. I got to go on one of the early ones with him, opened my eyes, and changed my career totally as a leader, as he did with many people. Helped science, seed science, genetics at universities. The list goes on. So I think all of us are taking time to really think about all that Owen Newland did for the ag industry and then, you know, reflect and take a look at ourselves and think, you know, what's our legacy going to be?
Yeah, truly one of those people, like we talked about at the start of the show, that set a foundation that a lot of people may not realize he was involved in, but really set that foundation through the checkoffs, through trade that you mentioned, and really just through the work of Pioneer and some seed product development there that we're still seeing the benefits of today. So, as you said, a big loss this week with the loss of Owen Newland. In just the couple minutes we got left, Jim, all eyes are on D.C. again as talk is ramping up about another coronavirus disaster aid package. A couple things you noted this morning, that there are a couple of big issues that weren't in the House package that need to be addressed. Bring us up to date.
Yeah, there are key, you know, questions. You know, why doesn't the House package cover 2020 crops, our expected third or fourth quarter losses for livestock producers? And it doesn't boost USDA CCC borrowing authority cap, even though yet that's being pushed by some lawmakers, USDA, and the Farm Bureau. So there are major differences there, John.
Yeah, and we're going to get into a long discussion, I think, about that CCC cap this afternoon on the Signal and Noise podcast. So if you want more about that, be sure to download that podcast tonight. But, Jim, the Heritage Foundation coming out against some of what you and I have been talking about on that podcast about increasing money and authority in the CCC to address shortfalls in the Farm Bill.
Yeah, they called it a slush fund. But if the Heritage Foundation is against something on ag policy, I'm for it.
Point well taken, but especially in the Senate, but especially in the Senate, people are going to listen to the Heritage Foundation on that.
Too many probably will. So it doesn't look favorable at this particular time. And again, if you recall, I personally agree with Colin Peterson that there should be some stipulations. It's gone too far, executive branch, in controlling those funds. I think it should be in consort with the key experts on ag policy, and that's in the Senate and House Ag Committee, bipartisan levels.
All right. A month or so ago, you were telling me we were going to have a deal in June. That obviously slipped. What's your crystal ball telling us now?
I did revise. Yeah, there'll be high-level talks. Yeah, there'll be high-level talks next week with the Senate coming in, and they want it by the August recess. Pelosi has already said if it's not done by the August recess, I think it's scheduled to begin August 8th, she'll postpone that August recess. So we're looking at the latter days of July into early August. So I'm going to straddle 2 months there for you. And I will eventually be right. We will have an aid package because this country desperately needs it. And the ag sector needs it because of the capital drain in ag.
Yeah, what is ag going to be looking for in this other than the CCC money that you talked about?
Oh, gosh, indemnity funds for the euthanizing animals, aid to the ethanol industry, more direct payments. The issue will be how and when. And the to expand the number of commodities that get these payments.
All right. Well, Jim Wiesmeyer, Pam Johnson, Sean Haney, always just an honor to be able to talk to you three here on the Free For All. I appreciate Chip letting me sit in for him today so I can be a part of the discussion. Thank you all.
Thank you, John.
Have a great weekend.
Sure. All right, and Jim Wiesmeyer, talk to you again here in just a couple of hours as we do the DC Signal to Noise podcast. And
yeah, we're
going to
have Gary
Adams. Be sure to check out Signal to Noise.
Yeah, we're going to have Cotton Council.
National Cotton Council.